Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is April 17th, 2015. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, graphic artist, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. On today's show, we will be talking about the laws of chaos. Now, what could be sexier than that? You'll find the laws of chaos in chapter 23 of the text. Now, while you're listening today, please join us in the 12radio.com private group on Facebook. And if you haven't been there before, the easiest way to get there is to go to the 12radio.com website, and on the left side of the page, you'll see a column, and you'll see a word that says chat. If you click that link, you'll be automatically redirected to our private group on Facebook, and you can ask to join. And our producer, Scott Weaver, will be there to bring you in. So thanks, Scott, for being here today. And Bruce, thank you for being here today. Are you with me?
I am. Thank you for having me back on your show.
Well, and thanks for such a sexy topic today, the laws of chaos.
I hadn't really considered that adjective before, but sure, why not? I suppose I was thinking of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. and then their arch rivals, the organization Chaos, and for those who remember that show, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Yep. No, I guess it's just that when you think about, you know, a radio audience and, hey, guess what we're going to do today? And it's like, we're going to talk about chaos, you know? It's like, oh, yeah, that sounds really great. But of course, to anybody who studies A Course in Miracles or understands the context, it is pretty sexy. It's great stuff.
I suppose so. I just never thought of it that way. I guess there's been enough chaos in my life that has been less than wonderful that I never really thought of it as having much appeal. But but now that you mention it, that really must be why we're all here, is to look at how we've chosen to be attracted to that and to be drawn in by that deceptive, the siren call, if you will, of the ego's seductive idea that somehow life apart from perfect oneness could be fun. Yeah.
Right. And the truth is, as we see, as we go through the course, or just as we live life, the truth is we are attracted to chaos. Let's face it. You know, very few of us really go, oh, yes, I just want perfect peace and harmony. I mean, how many of us have really, like at the very beginning of chapter 15, when it says, can you imagine what it means? And then it goes on to say something like perfect happiness or perfect quiet, just to just live your life in perfect quietness. And even though I love that line, it was very, you know, amazing to me when I read it. I thought, really, like perfect quiet and nothing going on? You know, so we love chaos. But the other thing I think that is so attractive about this particular section of the text is that to me it demonstrates the incredible logic of A Course in Miracles, mm-hmm. and how illogical and how nonsensical what we think really is. And so as you go through this particular section, I mean, it just makes me laugh because it points out how human nature, how hard we work to make something just ridiculous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I was having similar thoughts. Just this, you know, and Ken Wapnick does such a wonderful job of pointing out how the two thought systems, the Course's thought system of pure non-duality in essence at the, you know, the higher level of the teaching, if you will, is that of, you know, perfect sanity and perfect consistency. And the irony is that the ego's thought system is also perfectly consistent, but perfectly insane.
Right.
That's the only difference, is the sanity factor. But the consistency between the two is identically, you know, flawless. But it just happens that the laws of chaos that you know, are kind of the quintessential, you know, milestones or whatever, you know, thought, the logic of the illogic that the ego espouses is just happens to be 100% insane. And that's real obvious when, you know, the way it's pointed out in that section, which I think we, you know, might do well to read a few parts of it, because it just has so much in it.
And, oh, it does. I mean, it's just loaded. It's incredible. So thank you for suggesting it. So take it away, Bruce.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm just going to jump to the second paragraph. The first chaotic law is the truth is that the truth is different for everyone. And just that first sentence right there, in the second paragraph, is we think that somehow if truth is different, then we're ascribing the property of truth to our dreams, to our illusions, and to our belief in separation. And again, that's where I think the brilliance of this non-dual teaching is that it basically points out how crazy it is to think that we're going to find any kind of peace or happiness or solace in a world where everything is different. There's no consistency. There's no sameness. There's nothing that is shared. And how could we feel anything but lonely, abandoned, betrayed, threatened, jealous, unfairly treated, victimized, the whole litany of ego thoughts and emotions by believing that. I mean, differences are the bread and butter of ego, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and then it goes on, the second law of jumping to the fourth paragraph, the second law of chaos, dear to indeed to every worshiper of sin, is that each one must emphasized sin and therefore deserves attack and death. Well, when you spell it out like that, it's like, what? That's crazy. But
Is.
that's, I mean, but I think that's the brilliance of this section, as with the rest of the book, of course, is that it just points out how absurd and silly it is. And I love how Ken Wapnick consistently goes back to the idea that the ego, as we've made it up, it's not evil, it's not wicked, it's not sinful, it's just silly. And I think that's such a generous and soothing idea, because it lets us off the hook. And it kind of reminds me of years ago. I think I was actually up in the Sierra Nevadas backpacking with one of the first editions of the course in the mid 80s. And I was reading some of the sections for the first time where it talked about the difference between error and sin. And I was like, what a relief, because sin is irrevocable. I mean, it's like, too bad, tough luck, it's done deal, you can't change that. But the idea that if it's an error, it's just like, backing out of a cul-de-sac. You just say, oh, well, this is not getting me anywhere. I just put my little Volkswagen in reverse off I go, whatever. And I think that's such a relief to know that all of this insanity that we've bought into is undoable, and that our decision-making mind has the 24/7, 365 capability and opportunity to look at the craziness of the ego and not condemn ourselves for having chosen it. And I think that's the biggest hurdle is because we want to beat ourselves up for saying, oh, this is real. But that just makes it more real.
Right.
That just further emphasizes it.
Well, and in one of the early paragraphs, it says just what you've been talking about. Errors of any kind can be corrected
Right.
because they're untrue. And you're
Exactly.
right. What an emotional relief. It's not, we made a mistake and we can correct it,
Right.
which is so different than what we think of as sin.
Oh,
But you know,
well.
the other thing that in that same paragraph, I just think is like a gem of a statement. When brought to truth instead of to each other, they merely disappear. And what I love about that is, once again, it goes to the logic, is if we've got a faulty belief system that's at the very basis of this, like the first law of chaos, if we're already wrong from the beginning and we keep using other illusions to prove whether or not that's true
Right.
or false, we never get anywhere. And I just think that's so funny. So bring them to the truth, not to each other.
Exactly,
You know,
exactly.
don't keep using the same faulty thinking to fix it.
Right. I actually had a psychology teacher when I was at undergraduate University of California, Davis, named Charlie Tart. Some of your listeners.
Shirley Tart.
Yes. He coined the phrase altered states of consciousness, and I took that class and several others that he taught when I was there. And one of the examples he drew on the chalkboard once, I thought was really cool, is he said, here's a straight line, and he drew this slightly curved line across the, good length of the chalkboard. And then he says, well, here, I can prove it to you. And he says, now I'll draw a ruler. And he drew a curved ruler that exactly matched the curve of the line that he just drew. And I thought, well, that's brilliant, because that's it. We're taking two illusions and we're saying, see, this one proves the other one's correct. And
And we do that all the time. I love that example.
yeah.
And that's exactly what that paragraph was saying. You know,
Yes.
we just prove one thing by another false statement.
Right. And it ties into Einstein's famous quote of, you're never going to, I'm going to paraphrase this one, of course, but you're never going to solve a problem from the level on which it was made up.
That's right, from the same mind that thought it up.
Exactly. So as long as we're using ego to undo ego, we're not going to get anywhere. We have to bring it to the light. We have to bring it to that principle outside of ourselves that relates to shared interest and kindness and to seeing the folly and to joyously recognizing that we've been wrong and
Right.
that our individual isolated logic is whacked out.
That's right. And
Yeah.
but I want to come right back to this first law of chaos for a minute and just say, because I can see this being a real sticking point for people. The idea that, the first chaotic law is that the truth is different for everyone. And I can even find within myself going, well, but there are different truths for different people. But that's only within the illusion. It within the illusion, yes, there might be different truths for people, but truth is truth. And if we're really talking about what it means on a spiritual level, and you go outside of the illusion, no, it can't be different for different people. And
Exactly.
yet that is what we defend all the time. I mean, isn't that what a lot of religious rites are about? You
Sure,
know, that
sure.
politically what's going on now is what my truth is different than your truth, and we want to uphold the idea that there can be different truths. When the truth is, all they really are is preferences.
Exactly.
I don't think they're truth, they're preferences.
And I always like to find comfort and logic too, and in the idea that if something is really true with a capital T, it can't change. It can't be subject to variation or corrosion or dilution. If it's true, it's true throughout and really beyond space and time. And that's where our real identity is. And I think that's what speaks to us. That's the melos, if you will, that Ken talks about, the music behind the music, the meaning, the kindness, the quality of love that's behind the words and the writing of A Course in Miracles, we are drawn to. I mean, I think that's why, because we know that at some level, what we really are is truly the same, and that it has to transcend the appearances that we get so hung up with and so enamored by and so seduced by, to tie into your original adjective there, we or to use the dangerous African animal that I was making a pun on Facebook the other day is we think it's cool to be on our own, or we're ego's favorite African animal is hippopotamus, right? We think it's really cool to be doing things on our own, and the John Wayne ethic, I'll figure it out myself, but the problem is that the instant we buy back into duality in whatever form it takes, we're solidly in the realm of illusions again, and those illusions are what really are the byproduct of chaotic thinking and these chaotic laws that and laws with huge quotation marks around them. And I think that's what the course intends, and that's why it starts off with, in a very first sentence, the quote laws of chaos, on quotes around the word laws, can be brought to light, but they're never understood because how can we understand a dream? And that's what we're trying to do, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
And just, there again, always stepping back, being the observer, finding that inner kindness teacher, as you say, and being able to recognize that when we're in the illusion, and once again, maybe enjoying the illusion, but knowing the difference, knowing the
Right.
difference that T, truth with a capital T. Is that we are divine creatures, and that in a very real way, all that we ever want is to find our way back or not feel separated from God and to not feel separated from other people. So, at the basis of almost every single thing we do or the truth that we think we're looking for, it always kind of comes back to that, doesn't it?
It
You know,
does.
wanting to be loved, wanting to be accepted.
Yeah, exactly. Thinking that thinking, but with an experience, not just intellectual awareness, that our innocence, our true innocence, which is only valid in oneness, has never been compromised.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the real peace comes from, is that the unconscious guilt that the Course talks about is totally unfounded. And how could we, if we think that we're here to conquer, and that's what some of the remaining laws of chaos in this section talk about, if we think that we're here to somehow, pillage, loot, rape, and plunder, the rest of the cosmos, which is really the kind of the default mode of the ego, even though it doesn't like to admit that, it's a cannibalistic thought system. If that's the ego's standard modus operandi, then how could we not feel anything but guilt around that? Because we think that we have to somehow conquer and overcome and have power over some other aspect of creation in order to be peaceful. And how nuts is that?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and in fact, I'll tell you what kind of came into my mind. This may be kind of a side note, but I've been thinking about it a lot lately. And that is, I have a dog that I got, I'd say 4 years ago, and she's a husky, and she's a wonderful, affectionate girl. But the truth is, she had 4 or 5 homes before she came to live with me.
Uh-huh.
And the one thing I noticed, and particularly this week I was noticing it, is how she's always looking over her shoulder. It's like she's always looking for trouble, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
She never can just totally relax somehow and just know that everything's going to be okay, that she is safe and that everything's okay. And I think about that in terms of, these laws of chaos or some of the quotes in the Course where it'll say, just lay down your defenses. Just lay them down.
Right.
Because we're very much like she is, that we're always on guard because we believe in these laws of chaos. We believe this is what it's about. And, that it's either me or you. And if you've got it, then I need it, or if you've got it, maybe you took it from me, that kind of thing. And just that, when I look at her, I wish so much that I could convey that to her. Just lay down your defenses. It's okay. This is your home. Nobody's coming after you. We are okay. And yet I'm probably silly because it's a dog, and dogs in some ways are always on guard. But I notice with her, it's so much. And it's just really made me think this week, do I live my life that way? Am I always on guard for the next attack? Or am I always on guard for the next, what do they say, foot to drop?
Exactly.
And when we live with these laws of chaos, that's what we're building for ourselves.
Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely. Yeah. And that's where, we're basically stealing our peace. We're sabotaging.
Yes.
We're sabotaging our inner comfort by maintaining and breathing life back into an idea that somehow we yanked God off the throne, threw him under the bus, shattered perfect oneness, whatever metaphor makes sense. And well, of course, they don't make sense, but that we believe in. And because of that, we're always, like you say, on the lookout and on waiting for, the sword of Damocles to fall on our heads, because we know we set it up there. And we know that we've created booby traps in our manifest world because we think that we have done something unforgivable. So that's our task, really, is to keep forgiving moment to moment everything that comes up, and by bringing it back inside and realizing ideas have not left their source, the terror that we feel for the retribution that we're afraid of is only because we've believed that somehow we committed this cosmic crime, and of course we haven't in truth. But boy, we sure think we are. And I think it's great that you bring up pets, because, every single aspect of creation, really, including all the seeming forms, but it's all sentient,
mm-hmm.
is working with those same two thought systems. We're either choosing our inner kindness teacher, or we're choosing the ego, and our pets do the same thing. So, and as well as probably in some level that we can't comprehend, minerals and vegetables and
right
and galaxies and plasmas out in the cosmos, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's no matter what the matter, the form of the, you know, the matter that doesn't matter. It's the same principle. We either are choosing inclusion and oneness and the thought system of kindness and shared interests and forgiving ourselves for the dream, or we're rehashing it and using the past to jump over the choice in the present to recreate the same kind of past that we had in the future, and mm-hmm. keeping us on an endless loop of pushing Sisyphus's stone back up the hill.
Oh, having, yeah.
having it fall back on us again. So.
Well, and you know, one more, you know, example using the dog again that I notice is that part of her leeriness is that she's projecting and assuming that other dogs, and specifically the other dog that lives in the house, is going to do the same thing that she's thinking. So in other words, she's the one that's ready to pounce, but she thinks it's the other dog. And I mean, I just think it's so funny because I see her literally looking at the other dog. The other dog's just laying there, not paying any attention to her at all, right? And she looks at her like, okay, what are you up to? What are you thinking? And I'm like, sweetheart, that is totally in your mind. You are projecting onto her what you're thinking, not, you know, look at her. She's asleep. She doesn't care what you're doing, you know? And so once again, it's like the Course in Miracles just being acted out in front of me as I watch these two dogs.
Oh yeah. It's fun to watch, isn't it? And I couldn't help but laughing when you said literally. I was thinking, well, maybe that's another metaphor for ego's principle of division is always making a litter out of everything.
Oh.
The ego is the original litter
That's
bug.
That's right.
and the litter that we create, you know, as curs of ego's thought system, is always one of you know, like you say, having to look over your shoulder and thinking that, you know, the vicious dogs of victimization and attack. You know, we're always on the lookout for something that makes us vulnerable and gives us the opportunity to point the finger and the blame and say, oh, it's, you know, you took it from me and now I need to take it back. And it's always this tug of war, thinking that, you know, there's something outside us that is going to make us happy. And as long as that facade is maintained, you know, the ego says, ah, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And of course, whenever it happens, then we can say, see, there's my proof.
Exactly.
I mean, once again, exactly. Proving the illusion with another illusion.
Right, right. There's my curved ruler to prove the curved line is straight. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think the one thing to remember, and this is once again why I love this section, why I love the course, the ego is very logical. It's totally logical.
Yeah.
If you're trying to disprove the logic, you're going in the wrong direction.
Right.
But the point is, if the basis is not correct, and people who've studied logic realize this, mm-hmm. if you take a basic premise that is not correct, you can make it logical, but you'll never make it true.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we don't get, you know? I think a lot of us, we keep going, but this is logical. This makes sense. But the basic premise was insane, as you said. Just totally insane. And in fact, in this section, it even would say it's arrogant.
Yes.
I love how the Course uses that word every once in a while, that it's really ego arrogance to think that it could just make all this stuff up and that somehow it would be true.
Yes, exactly. And the logic is kind of fun, too. And I somehow, as you're saying that, I was flashed through my mind to something I read years ago. Is basically, it's like, I think it's like three statements. It says, silence is golden. Was the first one. And then the second statement was, it's almost impossible to talk with a mouthful of peanut butter. And then
so a mouthful of peanut butter is golden.
And then the third one is, gold is currently over, you know, $400 an ounce or whatever. And then so those three statements taken together, you know, again, there's some faulty logic here, but the conclusion was, peanut butter is an excellent buy.
Yes.
But I think that's the same kind of silly reasoning that and that's why the brilliance of the Course is that it if we step back from it and look outside the dream of space-time, which is what we really are all truly as one being, and look back at the the psychodramas and the soap operas of our lives, and which are steeped in laws of chaos, and see how silly and absurd it is. Like you say, it's completely consistent and logical within the flawed logic of the ego, but it's insane. It's just totally insane. But we so infrequently question that insanity. I actually, when I was reading this earlier, I was thinking about Richard Bach's book Illusions, and I was also thinking how nicely this section of the Laws of Chaos ties in with today's lesson. Which hopefully I'm not giving too much away that we're recording this a week early, but I'm doing lesson 100, which is the chronological lesson. That's my part is essential to God's plan for salvation. For anybody who's doing this on a week before this airs. And there's one sentence there that just particularly grabbed me. And it says, sadness is the sign that you would play another part instead of what has been assigned to you by God. And wow, I mean, that's it. I mean, if we have the least bit of melancholy or anything less than perfect peace and joyous stillness, which ties into your earlier comments, then we're basically saying, I'm willing to compromise that for the belief that somehow I've messed up and I want to punish myself and I want to beat God at the punch by punishing myself. And the way I'll work this out is I've got this elaborate drama where there's going to be things that I think I want and that others have. And which is the fourth law of chaos is you it says the law that you believe what you have what you've taken, and another's loss becomes your gain. And this is this whole win-lose paradigm, or lose-win. It doesn't matter. If perfect oneness is truth, then how can anything that involves loss in any fashion be anything less than
Right.
wackoness? But we buy into it because we think, well, everybody else has problems. I guess I should too. that kind of thinking anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, it's almost like, okay, I come up with this paradigm, I come up with this, and then I just keep adding these logical statements, and then I come up to the peanut butter is a valuable commodity,
Right.
in the end. I mean,
Yep.
that's basically not only have I created this, but I've been successful.
Ah,
I've
right.
successfully done this.
Oh,
I
it's
have
such a
made it so God cannot come and redeem me, and I'm beyond salvation. But you know what? I'm getting along, and things are working out, and I've been successful in making this whole little tower of madness.
And I think the success in quotes is always there's always a sobering moment when you look at the at your life, what we call life, and we look back on what we've made and realize, well, where has this really got me? I'm having a little bit of a moment of reflection because in addition to getting my taxes done, I'm actually mourning the loss of a dear uncle who passed away Tuesday. And I post a little tribute to him on Facebook. And one of the things that came to mind when I was thinking about his life and what he gave to our family and everyone I knew that, he came in contact with was just he was a very kind, generous, giving person. And it was always a very comfortable to be around my Uncle Joe. And I'm thinking, well, what is it that we are really trying to accomplish? And then if you think about the part in the course where it says, that I've saved all of your kindnesses and the beauty of all of the things that really are eternal, cleanse them of their errors, healed them of the distortions and saved them for you, and which is a nice little sort of second level metaphor of saying, that we can't really understand what our real life is about, but the moments when we let go of the ego's craziness and choose to be kind, choose to be to have an inner smile, and sometimes and frequently will manifest as an external one too. But do just those moments are when we are having a little miracle, holy instant, but as we might say in the course, where we've let go of this thing that we have to somehow achieve something in the dream, that we have to somehow conquer or take away from someone else in order to have something for ourselves or for our families or our country or whatever. And
Right.
that it's just so insane that we think that somehow anything less than perfect inclusion is ever going to work, even on the level of form, let alone in our minds. Yeah. And you also brought up a few moments ago what ties into the third law of chaos there, which is basically, and the paragraph says seven, it says, see how the fear of God is reinforced by this third principle. Now it becomes impossible to turn to him for help in misery, for now he has become the enemy who caused it, to whom appeal is useless. Nor can salvation lie with the Son, whose every aspect seems to be at war with him, justified in his attack. And now is conflict made inevitable beyond the help of God, for now salvation must remain impossible because the Savior has become the enemy. And that, of course, works on a couple of levels. Obviously, whatever we think of as Holy Spirit, inner kindness teacher, Jesus, whatever metaphor we use for the part that we took with us into the dream, that's our light, our beacon back out of it. How can we trust that if we're trusting, if we believe that somehow we have made an irreconcilable sin, if we've done permanent damage to oneness, if we think that's happened, and toward the end of this section, it says, "Brother, you do believe
Yeah.
it. Otherwise, you wouldn't keep rehashing this stuff." And it's just kind of a gentle reminder to say, be honest with yourself. If you're not completely happy, then there's something that you still need to forgive. And that's where the beauty of it lies, is that we have moment to moment an opportunity to use everyone and everything around us, not in a little less selfish way, but in a big less selfish way, to hold each other's hand, go home together. And in that really is our that principle of inner kindness is demonstrated every time that we choose to look past our own victimization, look past our attacks, and say, "This isn't working. I tried, I've tried it 7 ways from Sunday. It hasn't worked. There must be a better way," as Helen and Bill said to each other, so, and we actually try
Right.
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, the fourth law of chaos we've already talked about a fair amount, but that that we somehow think that there's something else in the universe that we need to acquire or conquer or have command over, or and somehow we think that changing some aspects or qualities or the orientation of things in this world is going to bring us peace. And not that we, again, as always, shouldn't do all the things that we find helpful in the world. But I think again, the attitude is, it's not about the behavior, it's about what we think and what we believe is going to make a difference. And that can be hugely helpful, can it? To
Yes.
just look at our beliefs and say, "Oh, I'm doing this because," and in our more mindful moments, watch ourselves, in our robotic ways, doing things rotely or without really thinking about why we're doing anything. And if we can catch ourselves and kind of gently laugh at that and say, "Oh, well, there I go again."
Right.
But not beat up on ourselves, not condemn ourselves and say, "Oh, I was thinking that if I did X, Y, and Z, that persons A, B, and C would like me, or I would achieve, this level of happiness because I think is going to lead to, a financial payoff of some kind, or it's going to improve my health situation, or where I live or where I work, or all those things." And again, it would be silly not to do the things that we think can be helpful and to partake of the magic, as we've talked about in previous sessions. But to just keep in mind that the magic is, is part of the laws of chaos, is thinking, if we think that's going to do it, if we think that's the form or the behavior, then we're just kidding ourselves, and that's okay. But just give ourselves some slack when we catch ourselves and say, "Oh yeah, That's silly.
That's right. Well, and you know, there's one paragraph in here I would love to read, so I'm going to
Oh,
go ahead and do that.
please do.
Although it's going to sound a little harsh, I guess, in context, but I think it's kind of the crux of what we're talking about, and that is all of the mechanisms of madness are seen emerging here. The enemy, made strong by keeping hidden the valuable inheritance that should be yours, your justified position in attack for what has been withheld, and the inevitable loss the enemy must suffer to save yourself. Thus do the guilty ones protest their innocence. Were they not forced into this foul attack by the unscrupulous behavior of the enemy, they would respond with only kindness. But in a savage world, the kind cannot survive. So they must take or else be taken from. And like I said, it sounds kind of harsh, but there again, and I guess I'm reading it, maybe I was a little sing-songy, but it's like that's what we do. We're convinced if only, you know, there wasn't this harshness in the world. If only these people were not doing what they're doing, then we could be perfectly kind.
Right,
You
exactly.
know, we would be okay, but we're forced into being defensive. We're forced into taking this position and to possibly attacking because it's the only reasonable thing to do.
And like Ken says, it doesn't start, at adolescence or early childhood. It's day one at birth, and like he, I one of my favorite paraphrasing here again, things is if you could translate baby talk into English, the first utterances, vocalizations a baby makes is really, it's not my fault. And that's it. I mean, because as long as there's duality, as long as there's an other, whether it's, and we develop that, we hone it to a fine craft, to a fine art form as we quote mature, unquote, by thinking that, well, as long as I have my scapegoat story and I have my drama that I can put right into this book that God is going to read in the reconciliation time, when I go before the big judge, I can say, see, all these people did all these horrible things to me,
That's right.
I was just innocent. I really it was,
I wanted to be kind. I wanted to be nice,
it
and I
wasn't
just
my
couldn't do
fault.
it.
Exactly.
Well, and it's funny that you bring up the baby because I don't think about that very often, but I was in a workshop with Susan, I think about a month or so ago, and she brought up that idea that, you know, from the minute you're born, that's it, you're saying, it's not my fault.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden I thought, there again, what an illusion we have of the innocence of babies. You know, the innocence that somehow we're totally innocent and then the world corrupts us. And yet the very fact that we're in the illusion and being born into the illusion, and I'm not knocking babies here, but just that idea that, you know, if we could understand what they're saying, they're going, what am I doing here? This is not my fault.
Another favorite Ken quote is nice people don't come here. And it's not to be, to dis everyone, but basically to recognize that by default, if we don't look mindfully at the ego and just play along with its script, we're gonna just be continuously reinforcing and regurgitating and reenacting the it sounds like a Mercury retrograde, right? The over and over craziness of ego's script, which is attack, defend, and retreat, and the victim cycle that basically keeps perpetuating itself because we think that there's something outside we need, and we think it's in other people's bodies or in their bank accounts or in their country's resources or yada yada. It goes on and on, but it's a cannibalistic thought system, and it is hideous, but only in a dream, and if we can look at it without recoiling in utter disgust and just say, oh yeah, this is a made up dream. I can look at the desolation of ego's story and its alleged laws, and its dog eat dog mentality, and say, that's just how egos are, and there's nothing wrong, because there's nothing, well, on the level of form, of course there is. I mean, and it'd be silly to you know, not do what we can to solve world hunger or prevent nuclear proliferation or, you know, or yada, yada. I mean, all those kind of just common sense things. But if we can look at, you know, Shakespeare's quote, there's nothing good or bad that thinking makes it so. And from the level that that was intended, that we really have only our judgments to condemn us. And those judgments always take the form of making some things good, some things bad. So as long as there's a we and a they, a goatscape and a lambscape,
yeah,
and woe be unto those in our minds that are in the goatscape, then we're basically saying I'm holding out on peace. I'm not ready for the peace I never left, because I'd rather look at this desolation and make it real. I'd rather look at ego's craziness and say, yep, I still want this. I still want to, not that we deny our senses, but if we invest in the belief that that's our identity, that's the clincher. That's the clincher where we basically say, I am this trauma. I am this trouble that I'm seeing. I am this situation with my body or my finances or my, you know, the world that I live in, the environment or the, you know, the people that, you know, relate to me and, you know, the plan, any aspect of anything on this planet that we think we're on or anybody in it, including our own alleged self. If we think that has power over us, then we're saying I'm solidly bought into and fully invested in these laws of chaos. And that's why I think reading these can be so helpful, because it basically just says, you know, all this treacherous nonsense is just silly. It's just silly. We don't have to buy into it.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, as you get farther along in this section, it says chaos is lawlessness. It has no laws.
Uh-huh.
I think that's funny, too. Like, yeah. Come on, get a clue here.
Exactly.
This is craziness.
Exactly. It's just like a Monty Python skit where,
uh-huh,
where it's, you know, and I remember hearing one of the Pythons, the troupe, talking about that, or maybe somebody was interviewing them and basically was saying how what made it funny is that they started with an absurd premise but continued to consistently work with that premise throughout the skit. And I think that's true. And that's, I think that's what makes our lives, as we call them in this world, absurdly, hilariously funny. If we are willing to, you know, kind of gulp and say, yeah, okay, all right, my rants and raves and all the things that I get upset about are equally absurd,
mm-hmm,
equally unfounded, untrue, and just, you know, self-flagellation.
Right. Well, and in fact, you remember Rosanna Dana on Saturday Night Live?
Oh, yeah.
You know, she would go on and on and on about like one time was euthanasia. And she said, uh-huh, there should be young people in Asia. Why would we be against euthanasia? And so she'd go on these total rants. And then, uh-huh, you know, whoever it was, would Jane Curtin or Chevy Chase or somebody would say, that's euthanasia, you know, or they would actually spell it out, and she'd,
right,
go, oh, never mind.
I that was one of my favorite characters on the original cast. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, Gilda Radner was wonderful.
Yeah, and that was one of the favorite skits of mine too, now that you mention it. And yeah, but that's it. Never mind.
Never mind.
I actually quoted Gilda in my second book as Rosanna Dana, because one of her quotes is actually, it's always something. And then Gene Bogart, who does Gary Renard's podcast, wonderful, wonderful stuff. If you haven't checked it out, or any of your listeners, he always says it's always nothing. And so I juxtapose those two quotes together, in one of the chapter headings, because that's it. I mean, we always, the ego always wants to make something out of nothing, and the Holy Spirit, aka Jesus, aka Inner Kindness Teacher, always says it's nothing, but you got to look at it. You got to look at it. And it's when we don't want to look at it, that we're just saying, I'd rather procrastinate, you know, and put off my happiness a little longer.
That's right. Why wait for heaven?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I like that byline you've chosen. That's really, really so true. I mean, we don't have to, we can really have that holy instant, that miracle moment, anytime, any place, regardless of circumstances, by just choosing the decision maker in mind and saying, I don't have to believe in these chaotic laws. I don't have to believe that God is inapproachable and unassailable and unredeemable and that we somehow have messed up perfect oneness to the point that there's no way out, because that's a part of the dream. No matter what the form it takes, that idea that says I'm stuck is just part of a chaotic thought system, a chaotic set of heavy quotes laws that are just nutso when we look at them.
That's right. Well, and towards the end of this too, it says, attack in any form has placed your foot upon the twisted stairway that leads from heaven. Yet any instant it's possible to have all this undone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once again, how comforting is that? Okay, You were going the wrong direction. You know, now you can just correct it. You can just turn around. At any moment, you can be moving in the right direction.
Exactly. And it all it takes is one step, one moment, one choice, one aha, mindful, gentle, kind approach to our thoughts that basically puts us out of the theater, certainly off the screen, and sometimes even out of the theater of the
mind.
and to where we can have a lucid moment to say, oh yeah, this isn't my real life. I need to be a good actor and do my part. But I can have simultaneously, like chewing gum and walking, I can actually notice my thoughts and not judge myself for having invested in a bunch of chaotic, crazy ideas that say that I need to attack and that I need to defend myself and I need to somehow conquer the world and the people in it in order to be happy, that I need to somehow change the dream and paint rosy lips on a skeleton, as another section in this.
Right.
Our paragraph in the section says.
It's so graphic sometimes.
Yeah.
Don't you love it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But we like to dress it up. We like to embellish and to make it sexy, you know, as your initial adjective that's opened the show, you know, suggests, that we like to glamorize and rhapsodize about ego's wondrous things in the world, because the underlying fear is if we see it as the plain sameness that it really is, the uniformly gray, drab nothing that is the ego's realm, we would basically say, well, why would I do that?
Right.
So you know, as the Course says in so many ways, we have it totally backwards. You know, we take what's boring, what's true, in truth, horribly boring and frightening and just awful, and we dress it up and give it all kinds of color and pizzazz and glitter and sound trumpets and film at 11, we're gonna feature this thing, you know. and yet, if all illusions are the same and they're nothing, how could we really get mileage out of that, except in a dream, except in our imagination? But we sure seem to, don't we?
Yeah,
it's
we do.
Pretty darn convincing hologram.
Well, and you know, one of my favorite sayings that, you know, it just came to me when I was first reading the textbook, that very first summer when I started reading it, and that is, anything multiplied by zero equals zero.
Yes.
And, you know, I think what a powerful mathematical statement that is, but it's so true with the dream. It doesn't matter if we have news at 11, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter how big we want to make it, nothing is still nothing. If you know, if it's an illusion, it's an illusion, and it still comes back to nothing, to zero.
Exactly. And the beauty is, we have a way back to the everything by looking at the seeming separate, seemingly separate, seemingly individual forms, including the people and the pets and the houses and the cars and the planets and all the various myriad animal, mineral, and vegetable and whatever aspects of it. Speaking of which,
yeah, the dogs decided to talk.
we can look at our beliefs, attitudes, and thoughts about every seeming character in our script, and say, "I made this up. I can bring this back into my mind. Forgive myself for any judgment that it that merits this particular actor or actress in my script as anything less than perfect oneness. If I can pull those back moment to moment, and shorten the gap between the time that we get upset or annoyed or totally flying off the handle, irate with someone or something, and rein it in, reel it in, and say, okay, I now can look at this as a projection of my mind, and realize that this is my savior. This is my perfect opportunity at this moment to forgive myself for dreaming a dream of separation and using this actor to remind me that I made it up. Then we're free. We're off the hook. And at the same time, the so-called other person or pet or thing or whatever is off the hook too, mm-hmm. because we're at that moment we are kind, because we're not condemning ourselves or quote unquote them for what quote unquote they never did.
That's right.
In an eternity that is outside of the temporal dream that we're having.
Yes. Well, and Bruce, our time is almost up.
Ooh, goes fast, doesn't it?
It does. But I want to thank you once again for suggesting that we look at the laws of chaos. Oh. And any wrap-up statements that you'd like to make today?
I just find that you know, they're very helpful. And it's in chapter 23, section 2, if anybody wants to read them in depth. And find more about what I've been doing with the course on acimblog.com and on Facebook. And then I always like to remind people to, you know, check out the incredible resources that both the Foundation of Inner Peace, FIP, and the Foundation for A Course in Miracles have online. There's the two sister organizations that basically are sort of the flagships of the course, and just a lot of wonderful stuff on both of those.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you for the recommendations of those websites. And just thanks so much for being here. I really look forward to our next conversation.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, and everybody, thank you for being here with us today. And thanks to the listeners and everybody in the chat room. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver. You can find me, remember, on Tuesdays for my other show, Simple Tales, where we talk astrology. You can also find me every Thursday night on 1-2 Academy, where I am teaching astrology basics. And you can find me on 1-2listen.com. But for now, stay tuned to 1-2 Radio and Fabulous Fridays. Up next is Christine Dumouriez with The Through Line. Until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.